My guest in the studio tonight is recognised as one of Australia's most creative and original contemporary pianists. In the jazz and improvised music genre, his talents have contributed to some of the most important ensembles in recent years, including Clarion Fracture Zone, Wonderlust, the Australian Art Orchestra, and of course, his own trio. He's been a successful composer for several film scores and has toured internationally to wide acclaim. Alistair Spence, welcome to Now's the Time.
Thank you, Frank. It's great to be here.
Or should I say welcome back?
Yeah, well, that's true, but yeah, no, it's nice to make a return. Yes.
We last chatted around about, I think, October last year,
that's
I think
right.
It was.
Just after the trio album, that's
yeah.
Right. Yeah,
and of course last year on Rufus Records, the music we just heard, you released this album with an acclaimed improvising saxophonist, Raymond McDonald. Now, this relationship stems all the way back to 2006, if I've done my research well enough, at a workshop that you participated in with the Glasgow Improvisers Orchestra.
Yeah.
Can you tell us how that all came about and how this collaboration sort of blossomed with Raymond and how it's flourished over the years?
Yeah, okay. I knew of Raymond through Sandy Evans and Tony Gorman. Tony, of course, being another Glaswegian, well, he would call himself a wherever he comes from, the a bit further away from Glasgow. But yeah, and Raymond was a good mate of theirs. And so I was aware of the Glasgow Improvisers Orchestra for quite some time. And his part in, he's a founding member of that group, and it has a lot to do with the direction that they take and the people that they collaborate with and so on. So when we had the opportunity to tour in 2006, we played some festivals in the UK, and then we went on to Canada. And before going to Canada, we went up to Scotland to visit Raymond, and Raymond invited us in on a workshop with members of the orchestra. So that was our kind of first chance to play together. We subsequently kept in contact, and then in 2008, I think it was, we went to Japan to play the Tokyo Jazz Festival as a trio. Coincidentally, Raymond was there at the same time playing gigs with various people, including a Japanese piano player called Satoko Fuji, who I've since become good friends with as well. And while we were in Tokyo, we played alongside Satoko at the Tokyo Jazz Festival, and then Raymond invited us and members of Satoko's band into a group that he called the International Big Band, and we played a gig at a club called Buddy in Tokyo, which actually became an album then called Buddy, and brought out on the French textile label a couple of years ago. And so, yeah, it's become a really nice thing to work with him, and I mean, I think we've got quite similar interests. He describes his music as being exploring the ambiguities between written music and improvised music, and bringing with him, along with that, his love of jazz, but also his love of pop and rock music. And I think we share kind of similar areas of influence in interest in the way that we play together. So.
Well, it's become a very well, not you can hardly say common, but it certainly is one of the most interesting aspects of jazz and improvised music, that sort of fine line between notated music and improvised music.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
even the definition, I guess, of improvisation and composition is becoming blurred because of all that, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, some people call it real-time composition. I mean, I know some people that actually don't refer to improvising as improvising. They think of it as kind of on-the-spot composition. And I think there's a case to be made for that as well. I mean, we all do a lot of study before we come to the table to improvise. So we bring that all with us. And it's very unlikely that what we're going to play is going to come out of the blue. It's going to come from somewhere in our subconscious based on what we've studied. So I think there's a fair case to be made for the blurring of the distinction between the two.
Yes, yes. Now, what is it in particular that attracts Raymond's playing to you?
I mean, these things come out of opportunities, I guess, anyway. So it was an opportunity and we grabbed it, and it turned out that actually, yes, we did have some very like-minded ideas about it. I think we're both pretty good listeners. I think we're both keen that the sum is greater than the the parts, and so happy to contribute without feeling like we sort of have to have, you know, the limelight. We both have a similar attitude that way, so it's easy to work for me. It's easy to work with him. You know, I think
that sort of works into my next question a little, because I noticed some of the music, I'm not sure whether it was on this album or whether it was Raymond's music, but was described by critics as bedlam. And and of course, for music to go into that stage where you could be describing it as bedlam, how important is it to have that rapport and that trust when the music ventures into that realm?
For sure. I mean, because when you're in that state, like, you really are committing to your instrument wholeheartedly. So you're just going, okay, something's going to happen here. someone's going to kind of figure out something to do next. You know, I mean, I guess you don't have too much time to think, but yes, it is nice to feel that the other person will actually think of something to do if you don't. Like, there'll be a way out, I guess, a way forward, without it just, as you say, kind of disintegrating or becoming so kind of looped around itself that there's no way forward. Yeah.
Yes. Mm. Last time we spoke, Alistair, we discussed your love of being able to, of building something. And this was in more of your trio concept. But when I listened to this album that we're playing tonight, this duo album, Stepping Between the Shadows, Alistair Spence and Raymond McDonald, the first track off that album, Trans Hemispheric, it starts off very atmospheric, I guess.
Yes, I can.
And then all of a sudden, this building that we were talking about last week takes over, and can you talk us through that a little?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that was actually our very first time playing together. So pretty much what you hear on that CD is the start of our session to the end of our session. The first track was our sound check, and then the rest of it was the gig. There's actually an audience in most of that CD, but I've edited out the applause. And it was one long, continuous track that I've basically chopped up so that it was a little bit more friendly for the listener, you know, rather than having to listen to a whole hour, you know, without before you press turn it off. So the beginning was very much, okay, what are we doing here? Well, you know, we've started. What have we done? Oh, he's done that. I've done that. Okay. And so that's our starting point. And then finding a way, I guess, kind of teasing out some ideas, or basically, I guess, putting some ideas out, really, for the other one to respond to. And pretty quickly it was apparent that none of us was going to have problems building on each other's ideas. So it really did snowball quite quickly in terms of its intensity and the ideas that started to come out.
We were touching on this, Alistair, just before that particular track, as to the sort of preparation, I guess, that goes into maybe a live performance like this. Are there any preconceptions or even any discussions when it comes to each piece of the music, or does it simply evolve like you were describing this particular piece that we just heard?
I guess it could happen either way. In this particular case, no, there was very little discussion, and in fact, the whole CD is pretty much our recording session from start to finish. At the time, it was recorded, apart from the first track, it was recorded seamlessly as one track, so with an audience, and I've divided it up into more listenable chunks. But yes, we basically just played for an hour, and for 7 minutes, and then an hour, and that's what we ended up with. So it seemed to flow very well. I do a few, actually. I've been lucky enough to play some really interesting duos, actually. I have a duo with Chris Abrahams as well, and I've played a duo with Satoko Fuji, piano players, lots of piano players, and also just recently with Myra Melford, who was out here in November. And in each case, we've talked very little about it. And with Chris, we get together every few months to play, and we just chat about the weather and, you know, who's doing what. And we're really not about the music at all. And it just seems to be easy enough to kind of discuss, if you like, while you're playing. I guess you kind of, that's what you're doing, really. You're going, what do you think about this? What do you think about this? Oh, no, that one's not good. Or, oh, that's good. Or, that's working really well. Or, let's stay with that for a while. You know, you kind of have that dialogue, I think, while you're actually doing it, without actually talking about it, if you know what I mean. So.
And there must have been a point, I guess, in your career that you got to that stage. You got to that stage of creativity. You got to that stage of musicianship to have that level of confidence to be able to go into a situation like that and create credible collaborations with people of the same. And I also noted that Raymond McDonald's case, he also has a lot of interest in collaborating with other visual art forms like you have as well.
I mean, for me, my interest or my resurgent interest in free improvising is quite recent, and then playing entirely free music is probably, it's only the last 4 or 5 years, I guess, that I've been finding a comfort zone in doing that. I particularly have found it very liberating. Like it's been, we were talking about it before, actually, like, is it composition? Is it improvisation? I think I've always composed by playing anyway. So for me, it's a great outlet. I can kind of try out lots of ideas and experiment with things on the fly. And so I've really had a ball doing it, actually. Yeah.
The liner notes indicate here that you play the prepared piano. So I wanted to ask you about that and how you actually prepare the piano. What have you done to it?
In my case, I actually haven't. It's not sitting there with things on it waiting to go. I bring a bunch of maybe percussion instruments. I use the wooden clave stick because it's got a nice tone to it. There's various parts of the piano framework that resonate, not only the strings, so I make use of those. You can set up sort of shimmering sounds by just kind of tremoloing with various things like the clave, or I use a triangle as well. A triangle is quite good for creating the overtone series because the strings on a piano are quite long, so if you place the triangle at various points, you get the harmonics occurring as well as the note. So that's quite an interesting sound, and you can make the sound shift through the harmonic series on the same note. So you can be hearing a note, but also hearing it, the harmonic shift on the note. So that I find that quite interesting. I mean, the person you were talking about before, Meg DeMaeus, she's really a specialist in this area, and what she does on the instrument is terrific. Actually, she has a wonderful repertoire of prepared sounds. I have some repertoire of prepared sounds, some that I've borrowed from friends, like Satoko has shown me a few things, Myra has shown me a few things. Yeah, you sort of pick up things from other people, but it's a nice acoustic way of being able for the piano to be something else, I guess, a textural instrument or a bit more of a soundscape.
How do you gauge the success of a performance of fully improvised music like this after you've come off stage? How do you know? Is it purely audience reaction?
It might have been at one point, but I think now I've done a lot of listening to a lot of people who are open improvisers or free improvisers, however you want to describe them, and that come from different points of view too. I mean, some people are jazz open improvisers, some people are classical open improvisers, some people are rock open. I mean, a good example would be the Aphex Twin. I don't know if you're familiar with his music at all, but he's a kind of electronica artist, but he's done a lot of prepared piano stuff as well. So there's people coming at this from a lot of different ways. And so I guess I kind of, in the back of my mind, I've got this sort of kind of library or collection of sounds that I kind of compare to, not while I'm playing, but I kind of think, oh yeah, actually this is up there with that, or you know, that was a bit weak or whatever, you know.
Yeah
I think it's like anything, you know, you can't, after a while you know whether you're on your game or not, and whether it's making sense and whether there's a flow to it or whether you're just too self-conscious to be able to get it happening or whatever, you know.
This may be a question that's totally superfluous given what we've already discussed, but what can the audience expect from next Wednesday night's performance if you sort of don't know what to expect yourself?
Right. Look, I would say we have a repertoire of sounds, and I think some of what your listeners have been listening to now is definitely going to be coming out at the time. Both of us are very big on melody, I would say, and form as well. One thing I admired about Raymond on this particular session that we did was that he managed to remember things that he played like an hour ago and kind of restate them as themes or variations on themes
Wow.
later in the session. And I think he has a very good grasp of the whole. So it certainly won't be kind of amorphous. It'll have song structure, it'll have compositional structure, it'll refer to the blues, but it'll also have some elements there that might be coming from maybe 21st century classical music or so on, or a little bit of rock and pop. You know, these are all things we like to listen to. But both of us have a very strong jazz background, so I think that's never going to be far away.
I want to go off topic. I was reading an article that sort of captured my attention in ABC Limelight magazine this particular month, and it was an article written by Alyssa Milne, someone who's not known to me, and it's headed up "Why No One's Listening." And I thought this would be an interesting something for you to comment on. It's headed up "Why No One's Listening." Ever wondered why many concerts of contemporary music are so poorly attended? Maybe it's because the music has no fans, suggests composer Alyssa Milne. Now, the flavour of this particular article is such that some contemporary audiences, go so far out on a limb without sort of taking their audiences with them, or without sort of even building an audience. Now, I'm not suggesting that you do this at all. In fact, you're quite very robust and rigorous in building your own audience base. She says things like, so if you're composing a 90-minute work about sewer pipes, who will find this work interesting? She's asking the artist, live events are built on a fan base. This holds true for a pub band as much as it does for a purveyor of experimental sound art. Any performer needs to build an audience if they want to have an audience. I once programmed a cabaret at the then Sydney Jazz Venue, and performers would occasionally tell me an hour before or going on to perform, I haven't told my friends about this. I wanted to see what the general public looks like. And she says, well, there's no such thing as the general public. I'm wondering what your thoughts and comments are on an article like this, because to me it does have some resonance, and I thought it would probably provoke some discussion in the arts community in Australia.
Yeah, I think everyone, I mean, generally speaking, I think it's hard to get people along these days to listen to your music. I think you have to work pretty hard at that. And of course, people have to want to come, so there has to be something about your music that they already like. So that's something you build up over time. I think the same would be true for contemporary classical musicians I'm sure it is, as it is for jazz musicians, as it is for rock musicians. What you have to give people to some extent is something of what they want, and then you take them a little bit further, hopefully.
You take them on a journey.
Probably you give them a lot of what they want, really, because, I mean, really, that's why you're there. You're there. We are there because the audience has come to hear us. You know, we have no kind of reason to exist if we're not playing for people. That's what kind of is the link in the music, is the way it's heard and the way it's appreciated. So yes, you could easily design a program that would completely kind of isolate your audience if you put your mind to it. Most of us would be very, very careful before we did that, especially in this day and age, I think, Like for me, for instance, I'm playing music that is not pre-written, but it's going to have a lot of the characters and a lot of the ideas that are already in my written music, say in my trio music or my composed music and so on. It's not going to sound like I'm somebody completely different. But yes, it's getting tougher and tougher, I think, to get, I mean, music, I guess, is in all its forms is becoming more of a niche, whether people now buy vinyl rather than buying CDs, whether everyone's got their kind of little collection of people that they like to listen to. And
of course, there's so many more distractions these days, Alistair. I mean, you can sit at home in front of YouTube and see all these other past performances or even present performances, almost preventing you from going out to see the live thing in front of you. It's difficult enough, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think the recorded output, as you say, on YouTube and on CD is enormous, and people can surf it so easily. Like, they can grab a bit of it here and a bit of it there, and it's very easy to forget, I think, how, and I'm speaking for myself too because I don't go out enough, how good a live performance is. I think there's nothing like it. You know, there never is. Nothing, there's nothing that will ever compare to actually being there and seeing someone and hearing them at the same time. You know?
Exactly.
But you just get so much more in the music. But those, we're all time poor. We're all kind of rushing here to there, you know, and just squeezing in a little bit of listening and trying to inform ourselves. What's the, Tony Buck used to describe some sorts of music as dinosaur music, like they'd start small, get big in the middle, and then get small again. I think this is one of those, the Brontosaurus. So it's kind of slow build and then a slow tail. But I think it's got some quite nice pentatonic sort of textures in there. I like this track, and it's got a lovely finish, I think.
Alistair Spence, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Frank.